There you go, the Tindalls, you got me happy. It's 8:30. Gavin Steinhovel, our attorney at law from Kloppers Inc., is in the house. Nice to see you again, Gav.
Yeah, good to be back, Dave. Sorry I missed last week. I was down with the dreaded lurgy.
I think you and half of the town.
I know, and I've still got the residual effects. I can't believe this is holding on to me so fastly. I thought I would have shaken it by now.
Well, apparently there are some interesting variants of the regular winter ailments.
Okay.
They keep evolving, and generally speaking, yeah, no matter what one does to stay ahead of the curve, the nasty lurgies find a way of getting
through.
For
those listeners who don't believe in evolution, have a look at the flu virus. It evolves every season. So.
Quite remarkable. I'm a firm believer of natural remedies like lots of garlic. Whether it works or not, I don't know. But no one comes near you, actually, you won't infect them.
Actually, you're to blame because I think last year about this time you said on air that the best thing is chili.
Yes,
and my wife got some chili from our domestic. She likes it really hot and put it in my food and nearly killed me. I would have taken the flu over that any day. So thanks, Dave.
Listen, I believe chili is marvelous. Garlic is marvelous. I think all these natural, but it's got to be the natural organic. If you can get it organic, that's the best.
Yeah.
A lot of garlic that you get in the supermarkets and shishi places is pure white and packaged in a sort
I know
of sock.
The bigger it is, the less tasty it is.
Well, also, it's been treated with chemicals to give it that pure white visage and to remove any pests, etc. And that somewhat defeats the object. So the more organic, the better. Beetroot is wonderful as well.
I happen to like beetroot.
You remember that one saga around HIV, and there was the cabinet minister extolling the virtues of beetroot and stuff. I think she was onto something, not in terms of HIV, but I think she was onto something generally about holistic medicine, natural medicine.
Actually, I used to ride bikes with a guy who made it to his mission, really, to, you know, especially in the townships and that, to get people just to change the way they eat. And sort of eat whole foods and stop eating like Lucky Strike and stuff like that. Not that I'm maligning that industry, but at the end of the day, it was just that, you know, your cognitive abilities are very much affected by your diet. And that if you're on a very sort of, you know, if you're sort of like on a putu diet, for instance, and you're not getting all these other things, then it is going to affect you and hold you back. And, you know, there was some sense to it. They got going. They had quite like a large organization at one stage, but obviously like all these things, they kind of peter out.
I was interested to see that at one time there was a very healthy moringa orchard or two or three or four in the greater Guadalupe region. And the idea behind this was that they discovered, firstly, that they started the moringa plantations with a view to creating biofuel, because apparently the moringa tree produces the right stuff for biofuel. But very soon they discovered that the properties of health and wellness contained in the moringa tree, in its leaves, its bark, its everything, its seeds, everything is edible, but it contains off-the-chart levels of the phytonutrients that are required for health and cognitive function. I mean, off-the-charts. They really, and there's lots of evidence to suggest this. So they started to incorporate moringa into the school feeding schemes.
Okay.
And it was, I hope it's still going, because apparently it was really, really producing results. Not necessarily, you know, they didn't measure the cognitive difference, but certainly the nutritional difference. A lot of those kids in those areas were affected with rickets and, you know.
Correct, yeah.
That was the immediately evident that those rickettsia and various other ailments of malnutrition were almost banished. A fabulous idea. Congratulations for whoever came up with it.
I've always defaulted to the fact that we're omnivorous. If you look at our teeth, you know, we can eat anything, and we're supposed to, and so just vary it up a little bit. You know, I think I find people tend to go, well, beetroot's a magic bloody vegetable. Everybody should have the beetroot, and then they eat beetroot all the time, which is not the plan. You know, you should have beetroot in your diet, but you should also have everything else. And so I think these faddish sort of things can do as much harm as what they can do good.
Yeah, well, clearly, I think anything done to extreme is not a good idea. Yeah. And apparently, particularly when it comes to, you know, suddenly you're looking at people that you last saw and they were hale and hearty, so to speak, and next time you see them, they are svelte and like stick-like, and you think, what has happened? And they are sort of, look at me. And how have they done this? Well, they've been taking all those little magic
Ozempic
shots of... Yeah, and apparently... Well, the results are very evident, but apparently there are side effects that you really should be aware of before you embark on that kind of protocol.
Yeah, I haven't looked into it enough, but you know, I do have more than one friend that's done the Ozempic thing, and it's been incredible. The results almost unbelievable, and I have said, look, you know, I mean, I believe that. You know, this is a double-edged sword.
Yeah,
it also has some downsides.
Listen, it's not...
And then some people would say, look, you know what, obesity itself has got its downsides. So, you know, if you can at least get rid of that, then, yeah, there might be other downsides. But
well, you see, here is my problem with it. And I think, sure, weight loss is good if it's sustainable. If you are overweight and you're suffering the consequences of that, then maybe a good idea to take some off. But these... Weight loss remedies. I'm not saying that Ozempic and the Wegovy and all that are old hat, but certainly there have been doctors that have been administering injections to lose weight for years. I'm going talking about years and years. Dr. Flack was one of them in the Gauteng that was famous. You would go to him and you'd get shots and you would lose a fortune of weight. And I knew people that did that, and it was quite remarkable. Looking at the results, you'd think, whoa. Every single one of them put back, as soon as they came off the protocol, in a very short space of time, they were back to the original size with interest.
Okay.
And I think that therein lies the rub, because no matter what the side effects might be, one of the big side effects is if you come off the Mooji, the body says, how's it? I've missed you much. I know, let's go. And they hoy.
It's like an alcoholic having that first drink again. You know?
Exactly. So you're locked back. You're locked into this protocol, I think, for life. I mean, I might be wrong, but from what I can gather from all the evidence.
I wonder what it is about human beings that makes us compulsive in some ways, you know, that sort of addictiveness that human beings have. It's probably like an evolutionary throwback from the times when you found a tree with a whole lot of fruit on in the middle of nowhere and you just gorge at it because, you know, nutrition wasn't that easy to come by. But there's definitely some little switch in our brains that makes us overdo things like eating or drinking or smoking or, you know, it's a strange business. They've never really got, as far as I can see, to the bottom of that. They've always treated the symptoms and not the
mechanism. It's a relatively new problem because up until recent history, people were nutritionally deficient and deprived.
Yeah.
It was very uncommon to have the kind
Dave,
of
you look at
calorific availability.
You look
that
at the newspapers
today.
From just, you know, the 60s and 70s. You know, Durban beachfront. Everybody's slender.
Yeah,
you know, you don't see anybody who's even remotely overweight.
You look at those pictures from going back to the pictures of troops going into the First and even the Second World War when they were stripped down for their medical examination. Many of them were underweight, not just underweight. You think, but how is this possible? Well, it's because the calorific availability back then was not anywhere close. I mean, here now, you can do, with one happy meal, you can do your sort of calorific
intake for the week.
Pretty much. And it's not a good thing because you don't just have one happy meal for a week if you're in that kind of groove. Yeah. You know, that's just your lunch. Yeah. And so on and so forth. And we've never had it easier. We've never had more luxury. You know, I'm sure you remember back in, I mean, I do, in our military days, when you were removed from soft furnishings and color and taste and flavor, and you were in this very hard regime of just that military stuff, when you eventually escaped that back into the world, it was like a fantasy to sit on something soft and colorful and, I mean, the lovely soft and warm. No, and that was that was just a one thing. Can you imagine when it wasn't available at all? I was watching Jimmy Carr doing a thing about a hot shower, saying, you know, that, you know, every time he has a hot shower, he thinks this is a luxury that until fairly recently was not common and not available at all going back just a couple of generations.
Yeah.
And, you know, we live like kings and queens, in fact, better. better. Mm. The average person now today lives better than the royalty of the past, by far.
Yeah, that's
and
a given.
We still complain.
Yeah. And I wonder if Voltaire wasn't right in his speculation that if you took, you know, four couples and housed them in a castle and fed them champagne and caviar and told them that their only mission in life is to procreate, whether they wouldn't just eventually burn the castle down out of boredom and wanting some kind of challenge.
Probably.
And, you know, that's probably what human beings are like, is that we, you know, we actually designed to strive, and we designed in a sense, not in the sense to suffer, but we're designed to overcome things like the environment, the lack of food and
you see,
predators and so forth. And when you take that away from us, we probably become purposeless. And
now, isn't that an interesting argument when it comes to the subject of artificial intelligence? Because what artificial intelligence is doing, and it's a frightening reality that there's been studies now conducted of junior school children in the developed world, where it's been shown that more than 50% not only familiar with things like ChatGPT, but using it. Mm. This is primary school. When it comes to high school and tertiary education, they now have to try and create different types of examination protocol, because people have been using AI to literally qualify as professional whatevers.
I know.
And they have cheated their way through brilliantly.
Well, Elon Musk said about his Grok 4 is that it can now do any exam at doctorate level for any subject in the world and get 100%.
So people are saying, so why must I learn this? I can just use my devices and have that information. Well,
I've got a good example of I recently had to do an agreement for somebody who was buying a business in Australia, and it was for use in Queensland. And I said to him out and out, look, I'm not qualified to do agreements in Australia and Queensland. I don't know exactly what their taxes are, and I don't know exactly, you know, how these agreements are affected by their local laws. But so he said, look, I'm going to pay an Aussie attorney a lot more than I'm going to pay you. So can you do the nuts and bolts of it? I said, as long as you promise to send it across to Aussie and have the attorney on that side just vet it, you know, run through it and make sure that it's compliant with their rules and regulations. And I regretted taking the instruction, because it was like not in my wheelhouse, and I don't really like to do, you know, anything that I'm not sure that I'm right about. But in any event, I woke up the next morning and I thought, well, you know, let me try this Grok 4, which I do subscribe to, but I've hardly used. And I typed in basically what I wanted. I said, you know, can you do an agreement for use in Queensland, Australia? It's a straight sale of business. We'd like to have some adjustment accounts at the end. We'd like to have a due diligence period, and. And without much hope, and I also said, obviously, we'd like to deal with the taxation issue as well. You know, how does this affect taxes? Cut a long story short, I pushed the enter button and in went my query, and I'm telling you, it wasn't 20 seconds and I got an agreement back. It had the definitions clauses, it ran through the sale, all the stuff you have to deal with. It ran through the due diligence period, how it'll work. It ran through the adjustment accounts that'll be done when the business is handed over. And it also contained a reference to their GST taxes, not VAT like ours, but the fact that it could be zero-rated from a GST point of view because it was sold as a going concern and so forth. And it had dealt with everything quite beautifully. And I thought, my goodness, I suddenly wondered. But then I realized, you know, somebody still has to know that it's correct.
Yeah.
You know, because you can't just, as a layman, just run off and sign that agreement if you don't know that it's correct. So you'll need some training to at least identify. And to its credit, it was 98% right. I made a couple of changes. Were they critical? I'm not sure they were, but I was very impressed. In fact, I was terrified because I thought, my goodness, this will put me right out of a job.
Well, no, but you see, you're quite right that you need the qualification at the end of the exercise to go over it and to make sure. Because
if you don't know, you won't pick up any errors.
That's the
thing. Yeah, I wouldn't have the confidence to do it in a different field, like, say, bridge construction or something, and it gives me all the calculations, and I don't know if they're right or wrong.
Well, there it is. You've got to trust this thing, and if you don't know, you don't know, and it's a bit late.
I can foresee that there will be a time where it's been wrong so infrequently, certainly less frequently than human beings are wrong, that you go, it's probably right.
Yeah, but you know the law of probability when you're, you know, right up there in the sky and you built this aircraft according to a diagram that you got off the.
And in some way, I kind of just hope that it's an enabler and not a disruptor, in the sense that it'll help people to work faster, more efficiently, and it'll basically scale up our ability as human beings.
I think it will initially, and then I think it's going to be a catastrophe. And I'll tell you why. Do you realize that for the data centers to operate, the AI environment, a relatively large data center apparently uses as much water as a small town per day, just to, in the cooling process. Yeah. It uses a huge amount of electricity and a huge amount of water. The water is not an infinite resource on our planet. It's fairly precious, and it's got to be potable water. It can't be salt water. It can't be sea.
So no, I know. I mean, I'd imagine that that it goes through the system, and but at least it's not being tarnished with anything. If it's just being used as a coolant.
But the problem is, apparently, the environmentalists saying yes, it goes into the cooling system and it evaporates. And it eventually will condense again somewhere, but not where it's come from. So if you're depleting a country, and a lot of developing countries are now becoming data center attractors because they've got water, for now.
Yeah.
But when the water is used, and it's been now raining, it's gone into the jet stream and it's coming down in the Sahara Desert somewhere, it's a different scenario.
Good for the Egyptians. They haven't had a lot of rain. But you know what also I noticed is that Donald Trump relaxed the regulations on nuclear plants and is going to allow them to construct little nuclear power generating units at their data centers. So the decentralization of electricity. And, you know, I've thought about this for a long time. You know, it made sense when electricity was brought to countries and towns that it would be centralized. But it no longer makes sense. You know, there's so many ways to generate electricity now that something like Eskom is really an anachronism if you think of it in modern times. You know, we probably have to move away from it.
Well, talking of which, is very interesting to see that there has been a move towards privatization of electricity generation licenses or distribution licenses. It's been challenged. Of course, Eskom is challenging it because they don't want to lose their grip. But it seems like there was a license granted the other day to the first sort of privateer.
Why would the state have anything to do with that? I mean, if I've got a factory, Eskom's been unreliable, and I find a way to generate my own electricity, or if you've got an estate like Simbiti and you decide, listen, we're gonna put a whole lot of solar up and go off grid. I mean, what on earth has that got to do with the state? You know.
Well, you see, what they say is, we have got to protect the provider of infrastructure, and if we don't, it's a bit like the argument for.
No. I get that they're saying, look, if people aren't subscribing to Eskom, then Eskom won't be feasible financially, and then the poorest of the poor who are getting electricity that they're not paying for at the moment are going to be affected, and surely they will be affected. But you know, maybe Eskom doesn't have to be that expensive. And, you know, if Eskom's coming short now, if you take a whole lot of people off the grid, that'll help them as well. So, and also, we all know that Eskom's probably running at about double the cost that it should be running at because half of it's being stolen.
Well, so, it's not only that, but the salary bill is crazy.
I know. I can't quote them off the top of my head, but I've seen the schedule of, you know, pre-94 Eskom employees and how much they generated and what the cost of generation was and what it is now, and it's just a joke. It's gone in the wrong direction by far.
It's crazy, and that sort of brings us to our last topic of discussion for today, which is the fight back, if you like, against the declaration of the weekend, John Steenhuisen's declaration that we need now to reform those areas of the law that are creating a burden for the economy to grow, and those are the statutes of BEE and
it's going to be a difficult one because there's so many snouts in that BEE trough.
Well, that, I see in the news today that the ANC has called for all beneficiaries of BEE now to stand up and be counted and to explain how valuable that the process is for transformation.
Yeah. And meanwhile, what is it, a trillion rand amongst 100 people?
Exactly, that's the point. The majority of folk have not benefited and will never benefit from BEE because they're not connected.
There's two things at play here. I mean, one of the things is it's as old as mankind itself, and that is if you're going to occupy public office, you've got a decision to make whether to, you know, serve your country or serve yourself. And these people have always served themselves and not the country. And, and nothing they've done has ever been in the interest of the country. And a dog can't have two masters. And you've got to make a choice when you're a public servant.
I think we circle back to our initial conversation about why do we overeat? Well, because when we didn't have anything, when we found it, we gorged because we didn't know if we'd have
anything. I often thought about that as an excuse for what's going on. But I think it's more basic than that. I think when you do your first little tender rig and you get money for nothing, it's addicting, and you'll continue doing it. It's impossible to stop. You know, it's impossible to stop, and we've seen it. It's just grown and grown in our government to the point where absolutely I don't believe that there's a single department that's untarnished, and I don't think there's a single politician that's untarnished. And
before we become too depressed, let's leave it on that relatively high note.
What I wanted to say, actually, you know, because we've gone all over the show, but what I wanted to say is, I've been saying it since last year, and that is that change is in the air.
I think it's inevitable now.
It's inevitable now, and you know, I was listening to Mike Sham. He's quite good.
Yeah,
the podcast, and he said, you know, all these things end up going not with a bang, but with a whimper. And I think the ANC is going out with a whimper. They're having their last wag of the tail, but I think change is coming. South Africans are not that stupid. We want better, and we're going to get better.
And that's a good point to pause. Gavin Steinhoebel, attorney at law from Kloppers Inc., back again in a week's time for
more. Yeah, looking forward to it, Dave.
And the morning show continues.